Get your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80, and ESPN News. I'm Jason Fitz. Start you off with some headlines. Fight Island is real. It's in the United Arab Emirates. And it's going to be the host of UFC 251 on July 11th. Then it'll host UFC Fight Night cards July 15th, 18th, and 25th. So at this point, we know that the fights are going to take place, and they're going to take place on Fight Island. It just feels cool. I'm just going to keep saying it over and over and over again because, frankly, it feels cool in every possible way. In the meantime, next up on the headlines you need, the Knicks parent company, Madison Square Garden, has issued a statement finally weeks after George Floyd's death. 8 days after Knicks owner James Dolan sent an email to the staff explaining why the Garden would not publicly comment on outrage following George Floyd's death, the company has issued a statement. The statement, a very simple one. Every one of us has a role to play in creating a more just and equal society where there is no racism, bigotry, violence, or hate. We stand with all who act for positive change. That's the full extent of their statement as made on social media. So we've now heard from the Knicks and Madison Square Garden. And lastly, a little bit of NFL news for you. As Todd Gurley, you remember he signed a big deal with the Falcons a little over a month ago at this point, signed for $5.5 million on a one-year deal a couple of months ago. He finally passed his physical Monday. Remember, because of the coronavirus pandemic, the NFL was not allowing physicals to be performed, but now the players could get physicals completed at the office of the team physician. Now that that's been opened up, Todd Gurley has passed his physical, so we can now complete that, put a little check mark in it. That deal is done. Gurley will now try and help the Falcons capture some of the momentum they felt like they had at the back half of last NFL season. Those are your headlines. First Take, your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, Sirius XM, Channel 80, and ESPN News. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. I'm Jason Fitz. We're taking your take as we go. One of the big conversations has been Fight Island. Marco in Texas, you want to chime in. What's your take on Fight Island?
Marco from Waco. How you doing, dude?
I'm great, Marco. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Okay, so they don't want to announce Fight Island. Tell you a little secret, they've been there before, Abu Dhabi, they've done pay-per-views to the same island before, so it's not new, just letting you know. But Dominic Foxworth today, I am glad that he brought up the fire pay topic. However, he didn't have enough ammunition because then I kept saying they just signed a new deal. Guess what? Every time Conor McGregor fights, he renewed his deal to get more money. And Jorge Masvidal, in his last three fights between Till, Askren, and Nate Diaz, he renegotiated his deal. The only thing they do is they keep tagging more fights at the end of that to extend their contracts. And John Jones, you know, he said he wants Deontay Wilder money. Well, here's an example. Deontay Wilder get 850,000 pay-per-views with Tyson Fury. John Jones has done that three times, with the two times with Daniel Cormier, then with Grant Page Jackson, and several times over 500,000 pay-per-view fights, but he only got paid $3 million per fight. So what is the fairness of that? Deontay Wilder made $30 million. And the best MMA fighter in the history of MMA has never passed the 3 million mark. There is a problem there. Peace out, brother.
No, thanks for your take on it. You're not wrong. I mean, the MMA is still, I think we sort of take for granted that UFC MMA has gotten so much love. They get so much conversation at this point, frankly, substantially more than we get boxing day in and day out. And part of that, it makes us feel like the UFC is sort of established. It's done. And I don't know that that's necessarily the case. There's still money to grow. There's still room for the sport to continue to grow. But there is definitely a pay difference. I mean, that's indisputable. And at some point for UFC fighters, they're hoping by putting themselves on the line and by putting themselves in theory at some different level of risk by fighting with and for Dana White when he needs them on Fight Island. I think that the hope's got to be that long term that that pays off. We'll find out from somebody that knows way more about it than I ever will. We'll get some Straight Talk brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless by one of the best guys at ESPN, one of the best in the business, ESPN MMA analyst and host of Ariel Helwani's MMA show. Ariel Helwani joins us. Ariel, first and foremost, I hope you and your family are safe and well and all is good. Thanks for the time, man. I appreciate it. What's your sort of reaction now that you've gotten the details on Fight Island?
Well, first off, Jason, thank you for having me. Great to talk to you again. Well, a few things. There's mixed emotions. Number one, I've actually been to Yas Island in Abu Dhabi for UFC 112 back in 2010. And it's not exactly your typical island per se. It's just a big desert, and it doesn't sound like it's going to be what we thought it was going to be, which is, you know, fights happening on the beach as the waves are crashing and all that stuff. But hey, you know, let's not take anything away from the UFC for making this happen, and it's very important for them to make this happen because this is a way to get the international fighters to start competing for them, because doing the events in Las Vegas, you're only dealing with the American-based fighters. So that is good, and the card is a great card. I'm also a little bit torn about the main event, because the main event should have been Kamaru Usman versus Jorge Masvidal, and they had contract issues with Jorge Masvidal, and so as a result, they went to the next guy, who's Gilbert Burns, who's a great fighter, and I don't want to take anything away from him, but, you know, you were just talking about, you know, compensation and all this stuff that's become a hot topic once again in our sport. As long as there are situations where you could just go to the next guy and pay him, you know, incredibly less, you're going to have a situation where Masvidal is going to be on the outside looking in, and that's a bummer, because Masvidal versus Usman was the bigger fight. It was the fight we all wanted to see. It was the fight that was in the works for months, and now all of a sudden they just go to the next guy and get him on a discount. So I'm a little bit torn on that one too, because I don't like to see a guy like Masvidal get blocked out.
So Ariel, educate me, because you're absolutely right. And when we start talking about money, part of it is supply and demand. We talk about it in the NFL all the time. Certain positions, we've been talking about running back today. Like, you don't pay running backs. Like, you get these qualifications from it. So when we talk about the money in the UFC, is the money there to be made in simply not being paid out to the fighters? I mean, or is there not the same level of cash coming into the sport that there is to something like boxing?
No, I mean, the model is completely different, because in boxing, you know, there are so many different promoters, and there's the TV deals, and the fighters make money off the gates, and it's just very different. And plus, you can have a situation like a Mayweather, who's his own promoter, and then that's why Mayweather makes, like, you know, 200, 250 million, because he cuts out the middleman. That's been, you know, part of his brilliance. But in the UFC, you know, the UFC doesn't make its financial numbers public, but based on all the information that we've gathered over the years, we have settled on somewhere between 12 to 18% of the revenue is going to the fighters. Now, if you compare that to other sports, say the NBA, it's more like 50%. When you start talking about the TV deal that they signed with ESPN, you know, 2 years ago now, and how much that is worth, and you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, 0% of the TV deal goes to the fighters. Remember when, you know, the salary cap went up after the TV deal was signed and the Warriors were able to sign Kevin Durant out of nowhere? You know, the players are making, you know, 50% of the TV deal, give or take a few percentage points. So they're not making any money off of that. There's a uniform policy where, you know, in the past they can make some money off of getting sponsors on their shorts and on their t-shirt and on their hat. They can't do that anymore. It's now, you know, Reebok is the exclusive apparel company of the UFC up until December. The deal is going to expire after 7 years in December. So there's a lot that the fighters are starting to finally get a little bit frustrated with. And, you know, each of them have their own gripes. They have their own, you know, specific reasons for being upset. But the common denominator is always money. And they're starting to look around. They're starting to look around what boxing is doing. They're starting to look around what other sports are doing. And they're starting to say, like, hey, my window of opportunity in this sport is very small. I want to get big bucks. I want to, you know, get the big money fight, so to speak. Why can't I do it? The problem is you got all these fighters, and the situation that just happened today will continue to happen. Go to the next guy, the show rolls on, and you know, the guy who asked for a little bit more is on the sidelines.
I'm shook when you start talking about the numbers. We're talking to ESPN's Ariel Helwani. First Take, Your Take, ESPN Radio. I'm Jason Fitz. I mean, that percentage is staggering to me when you start comparing it to other sports, Ariel. I will say, and I've said this before, a lot of people don't realize the economics of, let's say, country music. You know, if you go watch Luke Bryan play a show or an act like Luke Bryan, I don't know the specifics for him, but if you go see Jason Fitz, country superstar, and he's got this band behind him, most of the time the country superstar is making millions of dollars, and a lot of times in Nashville, the drummer might only be making $250 for the show. The reason is, if he won't play that show for $250, there's 100 other drummers that will. So, you know, they've sort of cut each other off at the knees in mm-hmm. ability to have value. So I'm seeing the similarity here. At some point, do fighters look at trying to represent each other? Like, do they look at unionization? Do they look at forming their own league? Like, what is the solution that can actually get them paid?
Yeah. So they've talked about this, and they all talk about it privately. I've talked to hundreds of them at this point in my career about this issue, and they all say the same thing privately. The problem is, just calling it like I see it, they're afraid. And I understand why they're afraid, because there's one dominant league that's run by one, you know, very powerful person, right, Dana White, and you have a situation where there's basically four levels of fighters in the UFC. You have the top 1%, right, and in the top 1%, you pretty much have Conor McGregor and Khabib Nurmagomedov. They're making tens of millions of dollars. That's a new phenomenon. Conor really, you know, started that, and no one really touches him. Khabib is slowly starting to get to his level, but there's a big gap there. Then you have the next level, which is basically the other champions, you know, the John Joneses of the world, the Daniel Cormiers of the world, you know, guys who are champions, who are established, so they're there. Then you have the contenders, right? You have the contenders who are on the verge of maybe fighting for a belt or becoming a champion. And then you have the guys who are just getting to the UFC and they make $10,000 to show and $10,000 to fight. Well, the guys who are just getting into the UFC, they don't want to ruffle feathers, right? They just finally made it after all, you know, the local shows and sleeping on, you know, mats and gyms and all that stuff. They don't want to ruffle feathers. Then you got the guys who are contenders like, oh my gosh, I'm about to break through, right? I'm about to get those title fights. This is not the time to speak up. Then you got the guys who, you know, have the titles who are like, all right, now I'm finally starting to make money. I'm starting to finally see, you know, some sort of return after all the years that I put into this game. And then you got the 1% guys, and like I said, there's just two of them. So no one wants to speak up. No one wants to actually talk about the struggles that got you to this point. No one wants to look behind and help the other guy. And what happens historically is someone will speak up. And it happened, the first time it happened, 2007, Randy Couture wanted to fight a guy named Fyodor Emelianenko, a big Russian fighter, and Mark Cuban actually sided with Randy Couture. Mark Cuban got involved, and they tried to take the UFC to court to get him out of his contract. But what happened was, they lost, and then UFC signed Brock Lesnar, and then they said, hey Randy, we'll do you versus Brock Lesnar, and then he came back. And so what happens is, they sign the guy, everyone shuts up, and we go along our merry way, and we forget about the issues that we were just talking about. Now, Masvidal is the first guy to start talking about, like, the revenue sharing. He's actually bringing this all up, and he's the one who's actually trying to expose all of this. Masvidal comes from Cuba. His dad had to escape communist Cuba. What I'm told is he's very upset right now. He feels disrespected, and he knows what it feels like to be oppressed. And those feelings are coming out. So I'm curious to see how far he takes this. But historically, they all speak about it quietly, but then when it's time to actually speak out publicly, they get afraid. And I can't blame them. I get it. It's their livelihood. But that's basically the reason why you don't see them ever coming together.
I mean, it would take, in theory, somebody that wants to be a sacrificial lamb, ruin their own career, yeah. Go after you. I mean, that's asking a lot of anybody, considering, as you mentioned, the amount of effort it takes to get to that level. We're talking to ESPN MMA analyst and host of Ariel Helwani's MMA show, Ariel Helwani. First Take Your Take, ESPN Radio. I mean, we brought you on to talk about Fight Island, and I feel like we've veered over.
Sorry.
But this is just where, this is, I think these are important conversations to have. So, when I look at Fight Island particularly, and you and I have talked since the first time that I heard the phrase Fight Island, and we've joked about whether or not it would happen and whether or not it could happen. We've gone sort of back and forth on it. Now that it is happening, you know, how much, what's it mean long term for UFC?
Well, again, it's like classic marketing, right? Because they've held events at this place. I've been to one. It's not exactly, on the beach and the sand and all that stuff. So, you know, they sent out a picture of it, and it looks like, you know, a cage in an enclosed arena with no fans there. So, I mean, I'm not losing my mind off of this. You know, we were all expecting somewhere in Tahiti or Fiji or something like, you know, like our imagination got a little crazy here. But for the UFC, it's big because they're doing four events there in July. And there's a very good chance, by the way, that they just do those four events. And then come August, they're able to do events, you know, in Las Vegas or somewhere else in America where international fighters can come in. So much can change in 2 months here in this pandemic. So for July, it's big because, I mean, look at the card, right? Look at the three title fights that they just announced. There's a guy named Piotr Jan who's in Thailand, so now he can come and fight. There's a guy named Jose Aldo in Brazil, so now he can come and fight. You have Alex Volkanovski who's in Australia. He can come and fight. So now you have access to a lot more fighters who couldn't come to Las Vegas right now. And so you see, like, the card this weekend. And the UFC has now put – this will be their sixth fight that they put on in the midst of this pandemic/lockdown, whatever you want to call it. The card this weekend is very thin, and I don't blame them for it. They've just run out of American-based fighters, so that's why it was very important to come out with this quote-unquote Fight Island situation, not because of the aesthetic, not because of the marketing, not because of the name, just so that you can have the international fighters fight on these cards.
Well, and with that, I mean, the other part of it, I've even admitted, the broadcast isn't going to look that different. Like, fighters fighting in front of nobody is fighters fighting in front of nobody, whether it's in Vegas or whether it's in United Arab Emirates. So what do they do from a UFC standpoint to try and make it visually look different, or does just the name Fight Island suffice for all the hype we need?
It's an amazing thing how this has caught on, because I've done so many interviews over the last, you know, 3 months or so about this Fight Island. I mean, it's a catchy name, and they now have like 10 or so t-shirts for sale on their website, and people just seem to love it. Again, I would say to, you know, let's temper our expectations here, because I don't think it's going to look like we think it's going to look like. And I'm not trying to be a negative Nancy. I'm really not. Like, the card is great. It's everything about this is great. I just want people to know that if you tune in on July 11th, there's a very good chance there won't be waves crashing behind the octagon, which would have been tremendous. It would have been a lot of fun. Nevertheless, it's great for the UFC. It's great for the sport. You know, the fighters, all of them are thrilled because they're able to actually make a living. Fighters don't get paid if they don't fight. It's not like other sports, right? So I think they're all very excited about it, and I'm curious to see what they're going to do for the other cards, the other three fight cards. Interestingly enough, and it's not a big deal for the audience because there is not going to be an audience, but they're actually going to, according to the UFC, who I spoke to just a few minutes ago, they're actually going to cater the card to the North American audience, which means that the main card, the pay-per-view card, which will air on ESPN Plus pay-per-view, will actually begin at 6 a.m. local time Sunday morning, so that it could air in the usual 10 p.m. Eastern time slot on Saturday night. So if you're a fighter who is going to fight on one of these cards, and Abu Dhabi is 8 hours ahead of us, you're going to have to stay on North American clock, and you're going to be like up in the middle of the night and all that. So that's kind of funky as well, because your body's going to be all out of sorts. I'm curious, usually when you fight in a place that's 8 hours ahead, you'll want to go two or three weeks beforehand to get your body, you know, acclimated to the time zone change. In this case, they will have to stay on North American time. And also, by the way, it's going to be like 107 degrees. I checked, you know, online. In July over there, on average, you don't want these fights to happen outdoors, right? The fighters are going to suffocate in this heat. So it's probably for the best that they're indoors.
The clock is a really interesting point to me, Ariel. So if you're a fighter, does that mean you stay in the States as long as humanly possible and go at the very last second?
No, what I would do is, and you know, I'm just me, I'm not a fighter, but I actually covered a show in Stockholm, Sweden in 2014, a UFC event in a stadium, and it was the same thing. They did the card in the middle of the night, and so that they can, you know, be in prime time on Saturday night. And what everyone did, including myself, which was very strange, was just stay on a New York clock. You know, I just stayed on the Eastern time zone clock, and, you know, we were fine. I was fine, but I wasn't the one who had to fight, right? And so a lot of the fighters told me it got a little weird, but I would suspect that most of them will not then go so early, because I think in this case it will be a detriment if they go early and get used to the Abu Dhabi clock. I think the bigger thing will be because it's unclear if it will be open. Like, I mean, it's very humid there. I was there in April, in 2010, and it was so humid. Like, the fighters would start sweating within seconds, and this was outdoors. This event that they did the first time in Abu Dhabi at Yaz Island was actually outdoors, first ever outdoor event in UFC history, and the fighters were so slippery after seconds. And so I'm really curious to see if they're actually going to completely cover it up, because they just held an event there in September. Another pay-per-view event, headlined by Khabib Nurmagomedov. I wasn't at that one, but my colleagues told me on Media Row that it was incredibly uncomfortable and they had issues with the air conditioning and whatnot. So even if it's in some kind of enclosed, you know, area, it's still incredibly hot there because it's literally the middle of the desert. So all these factors are going to be really interesting come July.
It's First Take, Your Take, ESPN Radio, ESPN News. That's some Straight Talk Wireless, everything for less, only at Walmart. Before we let you go, Ariel, I got to ask you about the NBA. For anybody that doesn't know, Ariel's great on NBA, covered it a ton, did a lot of work with Hoopstreams digitally last year. I love talking NBA with you, so I got to get your thoughts. Playoffs, do you like it? Do you hate it? What do you think?
Oh, my gosh, I love it. I keep thinking about the fact that, you know, in the dog days of summer and in September, we are going to have, you know, the Eastern Conference Finals. We're going to have the Western Conference Finals. We're going to have the NBA Finals. I mean, we would be in the midst of the NBA Finals right now, right? Like, this would be game 5 or 6 coming up if times were normal. And so the one silver lining to all of this sports shutdown stuff that I always kept in the back of my mind while it was, you know, very quiet in March and April and May was, okay, eventually if they all come back, this is is going to be tremendous. So I am fascinated to see how it looks. I don't mind that there are no fans there. I mean, I've been watching fights now for over a month, and having no fans there has not bothered me one bit. It's going to be like watching Summer League, only with the best players playing their heart out to try to become champion. I don't think there should be an asterisk on this. These are the elements that they have to deal with. I like the fact that they brought in some extra teams. I wish there was a way that everyone could get involved, that they could figure out some sort of play-in tournament that would have given, you know, the Hornets of the world and the Knicks of the world and the Hawks of the world a chance to just play, because it's going to be like 10 months before they return. But I am very proud to be an NBA guy, so to speak, that they figured this out. They're not, you know, they're not going back and forth on revenue and all this stuff. They want to play. They want to get back to work. And look at all the other sports, including baseball, who's making a mockery of themselves right now. No surprise, of course. I remember what happened in 94 when they broke my heart as an Expos fan and they went on strike. And so they're doing it all over again, and it's a shame. But I love this. I can't wait. July 31st, circled on my calendar, and I'm going to be eating it up. You don't truly know what you have until it's gone, Jason. And we missed, or at least I missed, the NBA immensely. I can't wait to see them back.
No, you and me both, man. I can't wait for it. We're going to have to find a way to carefully and socially watch a game together, my friend. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the time. Thanks for the insight. And thanks for the real education on UFC. I feel like I'm smarter today because you came on the show, man. Thanks for hanging out.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Follow him on Twitter at Ariel Helwani, and be sure to continue to check out his work. I think what's amazing about Ariel is that he covers a sport with the MMA, UFC world that he's so passionate about, but does it with such realism, and along the way gives you great coverage, but also makes you understand the sport better. This is what he does at his best. Coming up next, we'll talk with someone close to the ACC about Dabo's comments and, of course, the controversy that continues to swirl around everything that's happened at Clemson as a result. So we'll get all that coming next. First, pick your take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, SiriusXM Channel 80, ESPN News. I'm Jason Fitz. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. Our guests appear on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. You guys can chime in on the conversation. 888-SAY-ESPN, 888-729-3776. We've had some debates, and we're not really pointing you towards any one topic. We'll let you chime in on any of the topics. But one of the big topics of conversation today has been Dabo Swinney, the coach of Clemson. Remember, obviously Clemson found themselves in the news last week when a assistant coach, it was revealed, used the N-word when speaking to a player. Now, Dabo Swinney has not said anything since then. Last week, we had Paul Feinbaum on with us, and Paul Feinbaum talked about the fact that this story just sort of went away. So we've been waiting to hear from Dabo, which is what happened via ClemsonTigers.com, as they went to the official website. And Dabo posted a video explaining sort of the mindset where Clemson was and what Clemson's mindset is and has been throughout the entirety of it. It raises a real question about the conversations that need to be had, the questions about the reactions that we're seeing, and the questions about what we're supposed to accept. I'll go back to what a caller said earlier about grace. When you think about what we've seen right now from, you know, Dabo or from Drew Brees or from people that have come out and spoken in a way that everybody immediately says, oh, tonally, that feels tone deaf. Part of what we have to do is then approach that person with some level of grace. Especially when you talk about Dabo, it's not that dissimilar than Drew Brees in the conversation of benefit of the doubt for everything else that Dabo has done. However you think he should have handled this, the body of work of what he's done allows some sort of a conversation about how we feel like he should have handled it, but also how he should handle it in the future. The only thing that I will say is that we hold student athletes to a very high standard because they are student athletes and they're supposed to represent the school. With that same breath, I'm now going to say teacher coaches are also supposed to be held to a higher standard because ultimately they are teachers. That's what they're paid to do, and they're paid to represent their schools. So did Dabo represent Clemson the best way possible? That's a question we'll get some insight on from ESPN ACC college football writer Andrea Adelson joins us. Andrea, thanks so much for the time and the expertise on this. What was your initial reaction to Dabo's statements that were made on Clemson's website?
Well, I think he needed to say something. Over a week or about a week had passed since the news story that his assistant coach used the racial slur and the former players were coming out and criticizing him, and we had not heard from Dabo. And in his silence and in that void, other people were able to frame the narrative in the way that they wanted to, and it got away from Dabo. He was criticized. He was vilified by some, for not being as responsive maybe as he should have been. And so I think it was important for him to be able to address this. He had to. Now, coaches can no longer ignore these things. They just can't. You know, players are now feeling more empowered than ever to use their voices. And when you're running an elite level program like Clemson and you're Dabo Swinney, it can't be just swept away. You have to be able to address this. And he mentions this. So we addressed this head on at the time. Well, he needs to continue to address that head on, or else other people are going to have questions about him and questions about the way he has handled certain incidents in his program when they come to light.
Talking to ESPN ACC college football writer Andrea Adelson on the Shell Penzo Performance Line. First Take, Your Take, ESPN Radio. I'm Jason Fitz. So, fair or not, Andrea, when it takes a long time for a statement to come out, I think we expect as a society for that statement, when it does come out, to be very buttoned up and perfect. If it takes you too long to say it, then it should at least be perfectly crafted. Was the statement that he made, in your mind, crafted in the right way?
I think it was crafted in the Dabo way. You know, Dabo is not somebody who is buttoned up and perfect. Dabo is somebody who speaks a lot, and he speaks his mind. And so anybody who sat in a Dabo Swinney press conference knows that his introductory statement usually takes about 15 minutes. So I wasn't surprised that the video was 14 minutes long. There was a lot that he addressed in that video. And I think the only way to get Dabo Swinney in who he is to get him in that format where he's able to talk and talk at length and talk emotionally. Now, you may not agree with the way that he went about doing that, and I think there are probably still some people who have questions about whether releasing that video yesterday was the right thing to do, or if even the message was the right message that needed to be sent. But I think the format of it is exactly who Dabo Swinney is. He is fiercely protective of his program, of his coaches, and he gets defensive sometimes. And I think we saw a little bit of that defensiveness in that video. To me, it was true to who Dabo is. But I think it's really important for him and for coaches all across the country not to lose sight of this moment. They have got to listen to their players. They have to be better. They have to be more understanding. They have to be more empathetic. And they have to be standing right there with their players who are wanting to make these positive changes in their communities. And that's what this is all about, trying to be together and to forge a new way forward. And so I think Dabo, spending the last week talking to his players, getting a chance to really listen to them, hopefully will use this opportunity the next time he's able to speak to the media and maybe not have some of the shortcomings that he had last week when he had the teleconference with the media and basically framed it only in football terms. It's more than just football right now.
We're talking to Andrea Adelson on First Take, Your Take, ESPN Radio. I'm Jason Fitz. And that's really interesting to me, Andrea, because I've said this often on the college football shows I've worked on, that different coaches are able to basically assign their identity to a program and build it that way. So you know who Nick Saban is in Alabama football from a mile away because it's reflective of Nick the person. And now you know who Clemson is because there's this relationship between Dabo and the way he does business that it really feels like players and he connect on a very personal, emotional level. So how does a coach in a situation like that where he's built a program reflective of himself and his ability to relate to players, how does he walk the line between relating to players and then also giving the message that reflects on the university and doesn't alienate any of his fan base, which may not align with what the way some of his players see these issues?
You know, that's a great question. And I think that this is an opportunity for growth for Clemson, Dabo, the university, the fans, and the players. Because the reason that Dabo took so much criticism last week in his teleconference with the media was because he kind of almost tried to be outside of it. You know, it was almost as if, well, you know, these are issues and I'm just a little old football coach. And while that demeanor of I'm just little old Clemson works most of the time, in this instance, it does not, because there have been issues that have been raised by former players, and there are clearly players on his team who are hurting right now. And when you dismiss it as saying, oh, I'm a little old football coach, it's almost like you're dismissing the message entirely. And that's why Dabo had to address everyone yesterday. He didn't take questions, and I think the next time he takes questions, there'll be more difficult questions for him to answer. But there is no question that the Clemson fan base now has rallied around Dabo because he's taken all of this heat over the last week. But at the same time, you know, Dabo has to be there for his players. He has to listen to his players. He has to craft a program that is for the players. And so if you're going to not be responsive to what your players are telling you, and you're going to have former players or current players continuing to take the social media and call you out, well, then how can you continue to build the program that you've gotten to this point? That's why I think it's incumbent upon him, and not just him, but coaches around the country, to truly listen to what their players are telling them right now. Because if you are out of touch with your players, or you feel as if the players feel as if you're not responsive to them, how can you have a united locker room? How can you go out and recruit the way that you're used to recruiting? So it'll be interesting to see over these next couple of months, when all these players and the coaching staffs are back together. Remember, this is all happening in a vacuum, really, because these guys haven't been together for months and months because of the coronavirus. Once they get back together and they're able to see each other, it makes me wonder what the conversations are going to be like, and whether we're going to continue to see the types of public expressions from players that we've seen over the last couple of weeks.
You guys can follow her on Twitter at @AAdelsonESPN. Andrea, as always, great work by you. Really great insight. Appreciate you coming on and joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
That's one of the most interesting things to me is what she just said. I mean, I've told you, we're used to seeing the NBA be an empowered league where players know they have a voice and they're not afraid to use that voice. What we've seen, and what I think I'm surprised took so long to see, is that mindset is trickling across the landscape to all sports at this point. Because more so than ever, if you're a college kid entering school to play football, you understand your brand power. You understand your voice. You understand that you have the ability to use that voice for something. You have a platform to stand on. And what we see in an empowered generation is kids are more willing and want to speak out more. What's going to happen when everybody comes back together? Because I'm not sure that once the genie's out of the bottle, it ever gets put back in. I'm not sure a coach can effectively even attempt to or should attempt to silence his players' voices, which means coaches are now going to have another layer to deal with as coaches. How do they give their players the security that they need? How do they give their players the sense that they've got their backs that the players need? How do they relate to their players, and how do they be there for these young men and women across the landscape of college sports while at the same time representing their university and at the same time saying whatever it takes to make sure that the people that give money and those fans are also on board with the message of a coach? This job just became a lot more difficult for all coaches across the coaching landscape, because it's no longer just about what happens on the field. It's about the way you navigate very tricky waters off the field that will be part of how college coaches are judged moving forward. Coming up next on First Take, Your Take, two young quarterbacks in the Big Apple. Who's got the bigger upside? You might be surprised with one of the answers. You'll hear it next. First Take, Your Take, ESPN Radio, ESPN News. First Take, Your Take on ESPN Radio, the ESPN app, SiriusXM Channel 80, and ESPN News. I'm Jason Fitz. You guys can hang out with us on the Shell Penzel Performance Line, 888-SAY-ESPN, 888-729-3776. You can also tweet me at Jason Fitz to get in on the conversation. We've had a lot of conversation today about Dabo, and we've had conversations today about Fight Island, still my favorite thing in the world to say. But there was another interesting debate today on First Take, one that's starting to heat up a little bit because we are right around the corner from hopefully getting some level of an NFL season. And when that happens, all eyes will be on New York. All eyes are going to be on New York because you're looking at two teams with young quarterbacks. They both believe they have their guy. But it's never going to be simple enough to say, hey, congrats, you've got Sam Darnold, and congrats, you've got Daniel Jones. It doesn't work that way. There's going to be an inevitable conversation about who's better, who's set to be the king of New York City. Dominic Foxworth and Max debated that today on First Take.
I think that Darnold has shown an ability to, outplay the talent that's around him in many cases, because I don't think that they've set him up to succeed necessarily. And I've seen Darnold be able to perform against many different types of defenses. And that's the knock, I think, against Daniel Jones, is that Daniel Jones is a man coverage beater. And a lot of people, I feel like, are suffering from something I'm going to coin today, is debut bias. Like, Daniel Jones was awesome in that debut. And then since we all were bad down on that pick because he had a great game and that comeback win against, I think it was the Bucks, now all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, nope, we were all wrong. He's the best quarterback in the NFL. That's not true. Like, I still don't think that Daniel Jones has risen to the level of deserving to be drafted where he was drafted, but he was, and he's in a situation that I don't think is perfect. They have a general manager there that has made a series of inexplicable decisions, and they also have a head coach there that I think it's fair to say most reasonable people would say is a little unqualified or at least skip to the front of the line. So I don't have faith in very many parts of that organization. That defense was horrendous last year and it hasn't gotten much better. I don't have faith in the general manager who seems to hate numbers and said he added computer folks and that was supposed to make us feel comfortable about his decision making. And I don't have any faith in the head coach who was a special teams coordinator just a week ago. So Max, how could you possibly be excited about Daniel Jones in this situation? You agree with me, right?
I'll take Daniel Jones. Daniel Jones, you were just talking about QBR, Dominique, has a QBR 10 points higher than Sam Darnold last year. You know why? Because he threw twice as many touchdowns as interceptions. Threw 24 touchdowns with 12 picks. The Giants' offensive line has gotten better, but it's not exactly all world. He did not have much by way of a receiving core. His running back, even the all-world running back, Saquon Barkley, was banged up, really not himself last year. Daniel Jones is just talented. He's just, and by the way, this, better numbers, better QBR, the whole thing, better on his feet, like runs better, the whole thing than Sam Darnold, and that's with a fumbling problem as a rookie.
First, take your take on ESPN News. The funny part to me, this is like, if I'm a betting man, if I got to bet everything that I have on one or the other, either both or neither, I'm betting neither. Look, they might turn out to be okay quarterbacks, but right now, if you're betting in general, your best bet when you're betting on any team and any quarterback is to bet against them. More often than not, quarterbacks fail. Frankly, most of you driving around right now listening and your favorite team doesn't have a chance coming into the season, it's because you at some point drafted a quarterback that has not worked out. How many teams walk into the season really confident in their quarterback situation? Maybe a third of the league? The other two-thirds of the league, they're looking around saying, maybe, or they're looking around saying, oh, hell no. The reality of it is, Sam Darnold, Daniel Jones might turn out to both be okay quarterbacks, pretty good quarterbacks. And for most fans, if all you have is an okay or pretty good quarterback, then you end up hating your guy. We won't accept average quarterback play. Everybody's got to have the next Patrick Mahomes, otherwise they have nothing at the quarterback position. That's just the way fans internalize the quarterback conversation. So remember this, a year ago today, as we sat down and had conversations about which teams were going to be the best and largely based on young quarterbacks, Baker Mayfield was supposed to be the future of the NFL, the next great thing. And now, remember, Mike Tannenbaum said not too long ago on First Take that he could see the Browns moving on from Baker Mayfield if this season doesn't go well. That's how quickly the conversation changes. If you want to have a real viable conversation about your quarterback, understand that the real answer to how good your quarterback is maybe pretty good. That doesn't sound sexy. It's not fun to say. It doesn't have the same ring to it as being the king of New York. But realistically, most quarterbacks turn out to be either okay or bad, not great. And realistically, when you look across the board at Sam Darnold or Daniel Jones, you've seen enough bad or okay to justify that may be their future as well. First, take your take on ESPN Radio. Thanks for hanging out with us.